Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in the case of Bard versus Myers.
May it please the court. This is Richard Whitney and Carl Rubenstein will present argument from petitioners. Mr. Whitney will open. Mr. Whitney has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm Richard Whitney from the law firm of Jones Day Revis and Pogue in Cleveland, Ohio, and I represent the Commissioner of Banking and Insurance of the state of Vermont in his capacity as the receiver and liquidator of Ambassador Insurance Company. With me today are my partner, Mr. Chuck Gehring of Austin, and as indicated, Mr. Carl Rubenstein, who is here on behalf of Amicus Curiae, the California Insurance Commissioner. Pursuant to prior approval of the court, we have allocated 5 minutes of our time on the main argument to Mr. Rubenstein, and he will speak principally on the issue of the finality of liquidation orders of this kind as they relate to the application of full faith and credit. Your Honors, in November of 1983, the Vermont Insurance Commissioner petitioned the Washington County, Vermont Superior Court in Montpelier for an injunction against the continued transaction of business by Ambassador Insurance Company on the grounds that the company was in hazardous financial condition.
Was Ambassador a Vermont company?
A Vermont-domiciled insurance company that wrote business, property casualty business in 48 states in the District of Columbia.
Do insurance commissioners have the right to make such a petition against any company that's not domiciled in their state?
Yes, Your Honor, they can in the sense that an ancillary receiver does have some power to act with respect to special deposits that may be may be in the hands of that insurance department as a condition for doing business if they suspect it. But if you have a circumstance where you have a domiciled company that is in hazardous financial condition, the principal onus for protection of policyholders and claimants of that insurance company, wherever they be situated, resides with the insurance commissioner of the state of domicile.
For instance, if the Texas commissioner had moved first with respect to some monies that were on file in Texas, that case would have still, in your opinion, under full faith and credit, have taken a back seat.
That's correct, Your Honor.
To a Vermont case, when and if it was ever filed.
Because the domiciliary receivership court acquires in rem jurisdiction over the assets of the company wherever they are situated, and therein is the fundamental precept of that.
Why wasn't the suit filed in Vermont as opposed to Texas?
I was not involved in that decision, and I can only speculate. But in a world in which we find ourselves accused today of asserting some form of superpowers, the reality is that there is nothing about a liquidation that extends long-arm jurisdiction. I'm not certain of the status of Mr. Myers in terms of whether or not Vermont long-arm jurisdiction could have been predicated, but it is not at all unusual for insurance commissioners of the various states in the context of marshaling assets, and frequently the assets that have to be marshaled are so-called agents' balances, to go to the state where the agent is located to enforce or to make a claim. And it's ironic that we find ourselves defending against the notion that by doing that, we are assuming a superpower and claiming that a Texas defendant that we sue in Texas does not have the right to raise defenses. Liquidation orders, or the injunction issued by the Vermont Liquidation Court, does not speak to defenses. Any defenses that a claimant resident in the state of Texas or Montana or Georgia or anywhere else may have under state law to the claim brought, he has the right to bring and the right to bring in that forum.
Well, that presents a problem because there's not always a clear line between defense and a counterclaim that is used to establish an offset. I take it that you do draw that line here and say that Myers' actions in the form of counterclaims could not have been asserted as defenses?
They could. If what he is asserting as a predicate for offset or liability also stands as a defense, and as I understood the details of the proceeding before, there was some overlap there. There was a claim made that the prior management of Ambassador had breached the contract, precluding a recovery by the Vermont Commissioner on that contract. That's a defense. The bright line occurs when you go beyond the defense to claim offset or a claim against the estate. And the reason why that is a bright line is because there is a reality here that is unimpeachable. And that is that we are dealing with an insurance company that is an adjudicated insolvent. It cannot pay its claims in full. It cannot pay its claims in full to agents, and more significantly, it cannot pay its claims in full to the policyholders of this company and to the claimants against those policyholders, which under the preference statutes of the 50 states take a higher priority. It can't pay them. And the
position is, except to the extent that these are true defenses to the liability on the claim, as opposed to an offset, which would ordinarily, absent some inequity, be set off against the damages recovered by the opposing party, even if the claims were unrelated. In this case, the reality of the receivership is that there is no entitlement to an offset.
That's correct, Your Honor, because at the present time, Ambassador is paying to fourth priority creditors under its law. This preference statute is not materially different from Texas's. That's policyholders claiming under policies of insurance and claimants against policyholders. It is paying a total of 55 cents on the dollar. If you posit a situation in which a defendant sued by a liquidator in the context of marshaling assets is found liable, but that person is entitled to an offset, that is the conference of a preference, because that person is collecting, in essence, to the extent of the offset, 100 cents on the dollar. And claimants of this estate are not getting 100 cents on the dollar. And that, in essence, is what this injunction is designed to deal with. It is not a unique creature of Vermont. It is not a unique creature to any concept of the law that we know about, because this is not about being unfair to Texas claimants. Indeed, the purpose is to be fair to Texas claimants. Be fair in the only way we have ever come up with for being fair in a circumstance where you've got a company that can't pay its debts in full. The way you are fair is you create a unified process for the submission and adjudication of claims against the estate, because whether it be federal bankruptcy or whether it be insurance delinquency proceedings under state law, when you have a unified process, that's the best way of assuring the fundamental precept, which is that claimants of the same priority get the same amount of money, whether they reside in Vermont or Colorado or Texas. It is no different here. And indeed,
basically, then to do otherwise would put Mr. Meyer's claim ahead of a claim of someone he sold insurance to.
Exactly. Because the fact of the matter is, whatever may be the impact or import of this judgment that was obtained against the commissioner, under the preference statutes of Vermont and virtually every other state, it is a fifth priority claim. It's not a very sophisticated analysis. You have first claims under policies of insurance, the insureds and the claimants. By the policies of every state, they're the people who are really hurt, because insurance is nothing more than an unsecured promise to pay. that all of us rely on perhaps a little bit more than we ought to. But they are a fourth priority claim. Everything else is a fifth priority claim. And if Mr. Myers is entitled to recover by way of offset or by way of claim outside this process, he is obtaining a preference, and it's coming not out of the liquidator's pocket. It's coming not out of the state of Vermont's pocket. It is coming in the end out of the pockets of those policyholders and claimants that who are our principal obligees to protect. That's the only reason we exist.
Under the law of Vermont, or perhaps some other state for purposes of this question, if we had just exactly the opposite situation and it was a Texas company and a Vermont agency, would the law be as you're advocating?
Exactly, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, on the personal vignette side, I'm an Ohio resident. My insurance company is located, of all places, in San Antonio, Texas, domiciled there. If that company goes into delinquency proceedings, it goes into delinquency proceedings here. In Texas, the legislature has stated that in that circumstance, the Texas court, having the receivership, is not only authorized to, but indeed encouraged to issue the very same kind of injunction. I have to prove my claim in a Texas court. Indeed, there's a nuance of Vermont law, as we point out in our brief, that's slightly different from Texas, in the sense that under Vermont law, Vermonters ever being Vermonters, a claimant in Texas or California or Colorado doesn't even have to leave his own state to prove his claim. He has the right to prove his claim in his own state. What does that mean here? We aren't abrogating Mr. Myers' claim. We are not saying that Mr. Myers was not mistreated by the former management of this company. We of all people, in the trial below, it was established by Mr. Myers that we are suing the former management of this company on behalf of all of the policyholders and claimants in New Jersey. He can prove that claim. The issue is only the forum. And as I pointed out, it's not a way of skirting obligations.
Well, your position is the forum for his claim is in this proceeding in New Jersey?
No, I'm sorry. The forum for his claim is the liquidation proceeding. The Vermont commissioner is appointed masters in every state where there are claimants who have appeals. The process goes, you submit a claim, the liquidator acts on it, there is a reconsideration process. If you're unhappy, you have the right to appeal. The master,
there is a master in Texas.
There is a master in Dallas, Your Honor, who hears claims of Texas claimants, principally policyholders and claimants against policyholders, who are dissatisfied with the disposition or the initial disposition, if you will, given on the claim by the receiver. And indeed, Mr. Myers availed himself of process, or started to. Before this case went to trial, he took this counterclaim, literally, and stapled it to the back of a proof of claim and submitted it to the liquidation court. He put himself within the jurisdiction of the liquidation court with respect to this claim.
If this case is decided as you're urging, then is that what happens? He starts all over again with the master and proceeds on that claim?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Any determination by the court and the jury in this case is of no effect?
It is of no effect with respect to his claim. It is, of course, of effect with respect to our claim.
Right.
Were it otherwise, Your Honors, it is, for the reasons that I touched on earlier, I see that the green light is on, so I'd better back off and allow Mr. Rubenstein.
How much time is remaining?
3 minutes.
Please, the court, I appreciate the opportunity to address the court. As a soldier in the ranks of insurance regulators, the Court of Appeals decision is very chilling to me personally. That's why we asked the California Commissioner to authorize us to address this court. Over the years, I have represented the Texas liquidator in many cases. I was chief counsel for the Arkansas Insurance Commissioner in the Baldwin United cases, where we had $4 billion in liabilities but only three in assets. I was chief counsel for California, and that was the largest insurance insolvency life company in history. I then became chief counsel for the California Commissioner in the Mission case, which was the largest property casualty insolvency in history. We chased $2.5 billion of assets all over the world. We even had Kuwaiti Re as one of our reinsurers. And now I'm representing the California Insurance Commissioner in Executive Life, which is now the biggest life insurance company insolvency in history. All of those cases involve all 50 states. All of those cases involve hundreds of thousands of policyholders, literally hundreds of thousands. When a company goes into receivership, in effect, a curtain falls down. There is a significant fundamental change in the situation that existed before that date. From that moment on, the company no longer functions qua company. From that moment on, the company is an estate. That estate is presided over by the receiver as trustee for the benefit of all the policyholders. And the rights of the claimants to that estate are now governed not by their prior contracts. They are now governed by their rights under the statutes, the priority statutes. That rule is the same in Texas. And I have argued for Texas law. I have supported Texas injunctions in California and vice versa and in other states. All states have the same system. It's a peculiar system. It's similar to federal bankruptcy, but it's done by the various 50 states. The insurance buying public of this country is fundamentally reliant upon its insurance. Where would you be without your health insurance? Where would you be without your auto insurance? Where would you be without your life insurance, your mortgage insurance? What does any of that mean if there is no underlying system which protects the rights of the individuals as the policyholders in an even-handed and an equitable manner?
Well, I will, excuse me, go ahead. Full faith and credit does require final judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And this judgment is not final in the ordinary sense in which we think of it. That is, appeals have been concluded or the time for them has expired.
I think it is, Your Honor. For one thing, under your decision in Houston versus FDIC in December of 1990, and you have some other decisions in 91 which deal with finality. In the Houston case, you were confronted with the situation just as the kind of thing I'm talking about. The system itself, you have an ongoing new process. But how is that ongoing new process created? It is created at the front end by the order. The order which converts the company from a company into an estate. The order which seizes control of all the assets of that company and puts them into the custody of the court. The order which puts the iron bands of the injunction around those assets and brings those assets into the arms of the court to then be dispersed by that court in accordance with the statutes of the particular state.
But although in Houston we held it was subject to appeal at that point, it's also subject to modification by the trial judge in Vermont at any later time.
Well, one could argue that any judgment is always subject to appeal. You ought to have a bill of review or something. But this particular order, Your Honor, was appealed, and it's in the record. This particular order was appealed in Vermont. So clearly, I mean, it necessarily follows that it was a final order under Vermont law, and that's addressed in the briefs. Not only have we addressed it in the briefs under Vermont law, but in fact, this order was appealed. But I'm asking you to think about this with me. How do you get, it's as if the door opens. You enter into a new environment. You enter into a new situation. The company, particularly in the liquidation, the company is destroyed. It becomes an estate. It becomes a trust. Texas
recognizes. I believe you've made that point. And since your time's up, I'm going to ask if there's another
question. I'm
sorry, I ask if there's another question. Are you satisfied?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Tom Coughlin will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, it's somewhat of interest to me that there's no statement here, there's no argument. There isn't even really a serious argument that the Vermont order was a final order. And in fact, under Texas law and even under Vermont law, as we cite, it was nothing like a final order.
Why isn't it like final order? Why isn't it as final as the order in Houston?
It is not anything like the Houston situation. The Houston situation decided, I think in December of 90, was a situation in which there was a concluding disposition of the right, as I recall the case, to the interest on the proceeds in question. There was an order determining how that interest was or was not to be paid. In this case, there was nothing like an order dealing with Mr. Myers or anyone else's rights. Indeed, the off-the-record and out-of-the-record comments of petitioners make it clear that it's not a final order. As an example, counsel makes note of the fact that there is now a Texas master in this case, and I accept that statement. I have no knowledge of it. That came into existence in 1990, according to their brief. This case was submitted to the jury in 1989. The question before this court is whether or not we will write a new rule of law in full faith and credit with reference to insurance liquidation proceedings.
Counsel, can you cite any Vermont case holding that a receivership order like this one is not a final order?
No, sir, I cannot. Therefore, we cited to the court the Vermont Supreme Court case in Webster, which clearly defines under Vermont law what is a final order. It uses the term, what is a final judgment, what is a final order. It sets out the test, which is almost the same as Texas. It must be valid. It must be dispose of all substantive claims. This court's opinion, Judge Barrow's opinion, it's interesting, in Washington versus Williams is cited by both sides. Clearly, the order, the initial order entered in the receivership proceeding, the second order entered in the liquidation proceeding, do not fall within the confines of the Vermont opinion or of this court's opinion or of the opinions of any of the courts of this state.
Have the courts of other states refused to give full faith and credit to out-of-state receiverships like this one?
I'm not aware of a case in which the questions before this case were raised. We briefed it extensively. Obviously, petitioners did. Let me say this to the court. It is easy when reading the authorities or alleged authorities cited by petitioner to uphold their full faith and credit argument or their comity argument to distinguish them. They rely principally on the North Carolina life insurance case that went to the United States Supreme Court. That case did not involve the type of injunction we're dealing with here. That case involved a set of facts in which the North Carolina party went into the state of Indiana and actually litigated, participated in litigation, and then attempted to relitigate in its own court, and the United States Supreme Court in North Carolina Life decided that case on res judicata grounds. Now, they clearly enunciated the full faith and credit obligation as found in the Constitution, and as is enunciated here. I don't
know. Counsel, if the court did not create some type of full faith and credit doctrine or comity or abstention or something, would the ordinary policyholder or the ordinary small claimant ever get a dime out of a failed company? Or would all the money go to a claimant like your client that had such a large stake that they could afford to hire a lawyer and sue for punitive damages and so on?
No, sir, I don't believe that that's the case at all. In fact, I believe that the opposite is the facts here. The question here is whether or not the insurance carriers, whether it's here or in Vermont or elsewhere, must, under the full faith and doctrine, that doctrine, full faith and credit doctrine, correctly do what the law requires to end up with an order that is entitled to full faith and credit. And if they do not do so, If they do not do so, and that is not a final order, may they then just come to the court and say, well, this happens to be an insurance insolvency proceeding, therefore we want you to ignore the controlling authorities.
But finality is not a constitutional requirement. It is not a requirement of the United States Constitution that the judgment be final. The Constitution only requires that Texas courts give the same effect to Vermont judgments as Vermont courts would. And vice versa. And isn't it the case that it, that this Vermont order would be entitled would be followed by the courts of Vermont, just as the petitioners are arguing for it here?
I don't know, Your Honor, because I'm aware of no case in which the so-called injunctive action, I'm sure if there were one, it would have been cited, in which the injunction action and the question of finality of that order was ever raised. Indeed, in the authorities cited by the petition, they don't deal with finality at all. The Texas law and this court's opinions clearly do deal with that and have always historically dealt with finality. Now, as we see the argument, it is petitioner's statement that you should now disregard that. That is no longer a requirement in full faith and credit involving insurance companies. This court's opinion in this case, obviously, unless it is limited solely as petitioners seek to insolvency matters, reaches the broad spectrum of full faith and credit obligations from decrees and judgments of sister states. There are obviously public policy reasons why what is said in this opinion should include and require finality. And indeed, in the North Carolina Life case, the United States Supreme Court, by determining it on res judicata, said this matter was concluded in the state of Indiana. You litigated it, you appealed it. They cite also the Moody case from this court, which was an Alabama proceeding. As this court knows, in the Moody case, the litigants actually litigated in the state of Alabama, lost and appealed. In the state of Alabama, there was then litigation in Texas, and it was pointed out in this court's opinion that a final appeal and judgment was rendered by the Alabama Supreme Court. This court's opinions and the opinions of this state say that the judgment must be valid, final, and subsisting. We again direct the court's attention, as petitioner do, to Judge Barrow's statements that if the order is subject to modification in the Washington case, it is not final and is not entitled to full faith and credit.
Do you disagree that the effect of that rule would be that that Myers would get a preference in this liquidation?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
There's no showing of that, and there is no demonstration of that. Indeed, they concede to the court that Mr. Myers will have to take his judgment and go stand in line as a fifth, whatever it is, creditor in the state of Vermont. Absolutely not. And one of the authorities cited by the petitioners in this case was a federal case in which the Fifth Circuit, it's a Fifth Circuit case, I believe a Mississippi case in origination, in which the court noted that the party on the counterclaim could merely go forward and make his claim in the receivership state. There's no guarantee that Meyer's going to get any money at all.
So you're saying all he has, if they're paying the fourth class people 55 cents on the dollar, is the right to go to Vermont and get in line behind them in the fifth class?
I am aware of nothing that's going to give Mr. Myers any preference whatsoever. None.
That is your position?
Yes, sir. I'm aware of nothing that says that we may turn around and collect our money the day after you render your opinion. Indeed, we expect to have to go to Vermont, but stand in Vermont as a creditor with a judgment.
Do you also agree that you're obliged to pay the $28,000 adjudicated premiums in favor of Ambassador?
No, sir. Because the jury, the trier of facts, respectfully found that Ambassador breached the contract. That finding is separate and apart from other findings favorable to Mr. Myers on what may be talked about as his counterclaim. But independent of that, There was a submission to the jury of a separate special issue on whether or not, in simple terms, very, very simple, whether Ambassador breached the contract.
But the trial court rendered judgment for Ambassador for the $28,000. Is that true?
I don't recall that, Your Honor, and I should, and I don't because I tried the case, obviously.
In any event, if it did, you've not appealed that.
I don't believe that's correct, but if that's the case, then I stand by that, Your Honor.
And you've not appealed it?
No, sir, we did not appeal that. Now, the involved cross point in the fourth court, our position was that, as written by the fourth court, that in a breach of contract suit, the party against whom the breach is found may not recover. In other words, Ambassador may not recover on a contract which the jury found that it's written.
But since you've not appealed, if the judgment awards Ambassador $28,000, then you're obliged to pay it under your theory.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's correct. I don't believe that this court can allow a situation, or that it's proper, that Ambassador's theory against Mr. Myers was contractual. The jury said that they breached the contract. They cannot recover on the contract they breached. I think it's simple contract law.
Well, but if they do and you don't appeal, or if they recover on some other basis, then you would concede that so that there would not be a preference, you would be obliged to pay whatever was recovered against you, and with respect to your claim, which would ordinarily be an offset.
Offset, yes, sir.
You would have to go to Vermont and stand in line.
Yes, sir. To the balance of. And in fact, I believe that we will have to do that. In a general sense, let me say that none of the authorities cited, none of them deal with any test of finality, any question raised of finality of an injunction. None of the appellate opinions cited. None of the appellate opinions cited involve situations where there were, in fact, as is demonstrated in this record, subsequent modifications which are undisputed in the liquidation order itself. Again, we urge that there simply is no, you know, there are ERISA cases cited by petitioner. There are cases which have deal with future claims cited by the petitioner. In addition to that, we think there are public policy considerations here. And we think, since we are clearly, and we think the rule is twofold, the burden is twofold on petitioner. The first is to demonstrate that the order was final and to satisfy this court that the order and judgment they're talking about was a final order. The second is to satisfy the court under the Texas case law and the United States Supreme Court authorities, which are cited with the other authorities in the brief, that we have no obligation and you have no obligation to enforce an order which is against the law or public policy of this state. And in the case we have here, in which we did not have a final order, and in which Mr. Myers was obligated and under 97A had the right to bring his compulsory counterclaims against the commissioner, that is a right granted by the laws of this state and should be upheld by the laws of this state.
To what extent were Myers' claims defensive as opposed to offensive?
It was totally intermixed, Your Honor, because it dealt with the rights and obligations stemming from the so-called agency agreement or agency contract. A portion of that dealt with, as the court can tell in the record, with the handling of cases and claims that arose from the failure of the company. A portion of it arose from the improper and unfair dealings by Ambassador with Frank B. Hall Company and a competitor of Mr. Myers. A portion of it dealt with direct losses, damages, and injuries which Mr. Myers sustained before the liquidation, when Ambassador would not honor its duties to defend Mr. Myers' insurers, to pay claims to Mr. Myers' insurers. So it was totally intermixed. Also, as the court will see in the record, we called as an expert witness former insurance commissioner of the state to deal with the issues of the state law and the obligation on earned premiums, unearned premiums. There was a great deal of testimony on that, and that matter was resolved in favor of Mr. Myers.
Mr. Carter, before your time's up, let me move you to another issue.
Yes, sir.
How about the argument that as to the $1.2 million punitive damages, that for the court to allow that, that would violate public policy because a wrongdoer would not be the one to pay that, but the innocent policy holders would be the ones suffering that loss?
I understand the argument, and might be here on another day making a similar argument because I, like other counsel, as many members of this court know, have been known to represent many insurance carriers in my life. However, as I read the most recent opinions from the court, including the City of Gladewater opinion, the court has talked in terms of the multiple purposes which are to be served by an award of punitive or exemplary damages. And as I read those opinions, it's very clear to me that the court is talking in terms of a deterrence and example to others. And we speak to that in the brief, and the petitioner indeed does also.
Are you familiar with an 11th Circuit case in the matter of GAC Corporation?
I can't.
1982 case that talks more specifically about punitive damages against
No, sir. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I am not. And I cannot speak to the case.
Do you think the recent Hazlitt case might have any impact on what we said in the City of Gladewater or our traditional views of punitive damages?
It's hard for me to determine exactly where the court's going to go on that. I accept the reasoning in the Gladewater case and assume that we are in a similar situation here. And let me say that on a policy argument, I can certainly see that it is appropriate with all the litigation going on today with insurance carriers and insurance companies that in the modem of example or deterrence, it may well be appropriate to say that if the jury finds those damages, they should be left standing. And I believe that under the United States Supreme Court cases cited, that it is left to the court to determine what is appropriate and inappropriate in that area. I believe in this case that as the acts as found by the jury, the heinous acts found, and the damages awarded were certainly appropriate for the conduct that was involved. There were many, many violations, as the court knows, of DTPA and 2121 and fraud and antitrust violations and all types of violations that this carrier was involved in.
Counsel, in the City of Gladewater, we said that you could have recovery only if there was intentional, willful, or grossly negligent conduct, and it could be directly imputed to the governing body of the municipality. Here, the receiver, how could you impute any such conduct to the receiver?
It's clear that the actions of the receiver were not before the jury. The actions of ambassador were before the jury. The actions, any more than the receiver had a contract that authorized him to sue Mr. Myers. The receiver represents ambassador in the litigation, and the actions of ambassador were passed upon, Your Honor, by the jury.
The petitioner makes the point that at the date of receivership, the company, in effect, terminates its existence, like a human being would be when it dies, and therefore all that is left is the estate, and that you must therefore go under those laws.
Your Honor, we respectfully submit that whatever claims and causes of action were in existence against Ambassador on the date that they went into the Vermont court on the first day to seek relief, injunctive or otherwise, were not terminated or extinguished and could not be.
What would the Texas statute do in this case?
I believe that the Texas statute, as I read it, would make no differentiation that the cause of action would exist. If the findings were as what the jury found here, with reference to the actions of Ambassador, there was a long series of findings of the acts and conduct, but I don't want to mislead the court. The receiver, after he was appointed, the commissioner of insurance, it was not alleged that he individually or his agents took actions that were injurious to Mr. Myers after that order was entered. So the basis here...
Let me ask you a question. Forget about the facts of this case. What if we had a strictly an intra-state situation, and you had this judgment against an insurance company that had gone into receivership.
Yes.
And you had not collected on the judgment. Would you have to stand in line with the other parties?
I believe that we would under the statutes here.
So why isn't it?
And therefore, I think we're in the same position in Vermont. In other words, whatever, if the court affirms the decision, we believe that we're going to have to take the judgment then to Vermont, or they now say for the last year we're able, subsequent to the jury trial, to go to Dallas to present.
Well, but then you're not at cross purposes here. I heard district counsel correctly. That's the argument he's making, that you would go to Vermont or wherever and just get in line with the policyholders.
Yes, but the difference is whether or not we have to try the lawsuit in Vermont, Your Honor, or in Dallas. Whether we have to go through another 3 weeks of trial to prove our case. And we respectfully submit that they chose this jurisdiction without a final order, with an order that was subject to modification, and they concede that it was modified a number of times subsequently.
I believe you've answered my question.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Your Honors, let me suggest, first of all, that the fact that Mr. Coughlin seems now to concede that he would have to go to Vermont and stand in line with this judgment, just like everybody else, kind of captures what the purpose behind this injunction is.
Let me make sure that I understand it correctly. You're not saying that Mr. Coughlin and his client, Mr. Myers, insurance agencies, et cetera, have to go to Vermont and prove their claim and start over.
That's exactly what we're saying, Your Honor, because the claim never should have gone to trial in Texas in the first place. There is a bright line here between matters of defense and matters of claims, and the bright line is, to the extent he is making claims against the estate for monies from the estate, that is a matter.
He's not making claims against it. Well, he wants the estate to pay, but he's got a judgment.
That's right, Your Honor.
Finding that you're
but that claim should have gone to the liquidation process and not to the court. And indeed,
well, there was no receiver at the time this case was litigated, as I understand.
There was, Your Honor. Not only was there a receiver, but at the time this case went to trial, we had a liquidation order. There was a final liquidation order. The rehabilitation order contained the same injunction, and that was in place as of the time the lawsuit was filed. The receiver filed the lawsuit. As of the time the case went to trial, as of the morning of the trial of this claim, this company had been determined to be liquidated. It was under a liquidation order. And on the notion of finality, let me suggest to the court two things. What can be more final than a determination by a court that an insurance company ceases to exist, that policies are deemed terminated, that everybody's rights are fixed by the order? As the Court of Appeals recognized in Moody versus State, yes, there are provisions in the order that contemplate a further supervision by the court. There has to be. It takes between 12 and 20 years to liquidate a property casualty insurance company. The reason is because when you're writing casualty lines of insurance like medical malpractice, and you're living in a world where thou shalt not confer a preference, that means that you have to try to, at the one hand, maximize the payment you can make now, but be sure that that minor with a medical malpractice claim, or the person who got the sponge left in their stomach that doesn't know about it, that person is going to be protected when that claim is discovered. It takes that kind of time. And when you're dealing with the marshaling of assets like this, those kinds of provisions must be in the order, but it doesn't make it non-final. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in both of these causes. The foregoing causes are submitted on brief and oral argument. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.